תראה, אדם חכם לימד אותי שיש את שלושת החפים. כוח, כבוד וכסף.
Money, power and respect. That is the philosophy in a nutshell. Under the cover of demand to improve ability of governance, the coalition members narrowed civil rights. They cut budgets for minorities and non-for-profit organizations, while over-budgeting the ultra-Orthodox and religious Zionism projects. The Likud, which used to be a liberal party, is now the populist party, which appoints point persons only based on their loyalty to Netanyahu or being good friends with Likud politicians who gain benefits from them. To discuss the looting of the nation's resources, I am glad to have Eran Etzion, former deputy head of the National Security Council and former head of the Policy Planning Division in Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and currently a protester against the judicial upheaval again. So, Eran, welcome back to Balagan.
Hi, great to be here again.
What do you think about the philosophy presented by a member of the Knesset, Miki Zohar of the Likud?
Well, I wish it were just philosophy. It's not only philosophy, it's an immense power grab that actually has been going on for years on a lower magnitude and has engulfed the entire Likud party and the entire coalition in the last 8 months as part of the overall putsch and attempted regime change that Netanyahu personally is leading for his criminal reasons with a monstrous coalition of extremists from the Haredi community, from the ultra-national religious community, and from the Likud itself, one of whom is Miki Zohar that you quoted. It's a huge job industry, as you say. It is a looting operation, and it ties together, unfortunately, not only those who seek, again, as Miki Zohar said, power, money, and honor, dignity, respect. There are important nuances here.
Yeah,
but it's the kind of respect that comes from authority, from government positions, from controlling budgets. It's not the kind of respect that you earn because of your honorable personality or your good deeds in the eyes of God or in the eyes of your community or anything like that. It's quite the opposite. It's the kind of mafia honor, if you will, that we saw in Scorsese movies. That is unfortunately what's going on in Israel. It's very palpable. It has already a huge impact on the economy, on the society, on the overall kind of atmosphere in the country. And this is what driven and is still driving millions to the streets in an unprecedented way in terms of the pro-democracy protest that has been going on for, what is it now, almost 8 months, every week and sometimes a couple of times a week, something that is unprecedented not only in Israeli history, but in the world history.
Some people will say that politicians have always been corruption all around the world and the democracies are not different. And then in previous years, we can remember that we already had an indicted prime minister, an indicted president, both set in prison in Israel. And some politicians actually in the 70s used to commit suicide. I'm not saying that that's the preferred solution, but they wanted to keep their dignity. So what makes this coalition different than other coalitions in the past?
It's like the difference between crime and organized crime. This is on the level of organized crime on a national scale. And when you have political organizations, parties, political movements, political outfits that are unabashedly acting like mafia organizations, going after money, going after national budgets, going after official government jobs, going after the kind of mafia honor that we discussed, those three, in Hebrew, it's kaf, the letter kaf sounds like K, so it's like KKK, our version of the KKK. Yes.
Yeah.
So when you have it organized in this way and led by the prime minister and all of the ministers without exception, that have taken over all of the government ministries and along the road invented fictitious government ministries and are feeding those fictitious government ministries with billions and billions of shekels, really in ways that were never seen before. as you correctly said, we had corruption before. We had a prime minister, Ehud Olmert, that sat in prison. We had a finance minister that sat in prison. But these were, shall we say, isolated incidents that I think we can safely say were attributable to certain political personalities and not to complete political organizations. Likud has changed that, and this coalition has changed that. And we have now political outfits, political parties, that are acting exactly like organized crime operations. And because it's on a national scale, because it's in the billions and tens of billions of shekels, because it has to do with tens of thousands of government-funded jobs, and let alone the municipal level, which has been as corrupt as our federal or our government level for many years, if not more, and we're now going to municipal elections at the end of October. We'll see what happens there. But really the bottom line here is that the scale of the criminal operation has grown exponentially in this government, in Netanyahu's sixth government, compared to his previous governments and compared to any other previous Israeli government.
We're talking about the judicial overhaul, of course, and it has to be connected. I mean, when you're talking about weakening the gatekeepers, and the unreasonable clause that was now banned, and there's going to be a discussion at the Supreme Court in September. Can you explain how is it all connected, how it all works?
I think the correct term is not a judicial overhaul. It's a complete regime change or a putsch attempted by the government. It's not a revolution, because a revolution is from the bottom up. This emanates from the government itself. It's a putsch or a regime change attempted by the prime minister and the government themselves. It far exceeds any kind of judicial reform or judicial overhaul. It has a lot more facets than simply the judicial or legalistic aspect that so many people are focusing on. So it is all tied together. It is a combination, a very unfortunate combination from a national Israeli perspective, that brings together Netanyahu's criminal motivations, which are very critical to understand when looking at what's going on in Israel these days. He's desperate to escape justice and to avoid being indicted and very possibly go to jail. Yeah. And this is a primary motivation of his. And he's aided and abetted by a number of agendas that are represented in parliament, in the Knesset, by certain tribes, if you will, or political elements, political organizations identified with the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, and the national religious, the settler movement, and those affiliated with it. And those three agendas, one is Netanyahu's personal agenda. Perhaps it's four agendas. One is Netanyahu's personal agenda. The second is the Likud's organizational agenda, which we just discussed, this KKK agenda. Money, power, and respect. And then there is the Haredi agenda, which is essentially living at the expense of the wider Israeli public, the non-Haredi public, taxpayers, people who actually go to work and serve in the military, and those that sustain Israel, Israel that we all know. While the Haredim are allowed to essentially live in a separatist ghetto, having their own educational systems that do not teach English or math or sciences or civics, avoid work, avoid military service, and actually live on government subsidies. So now they want to perpetuate. They are growing exponentially demographically, because the average Haredi mother has approximately, if I remember correctly, 6.7 kids or something like that. It's the highest in the Middle East. And because they are now growing in numbers, and because their political influence is growing, and because they know that Netanyahu depends on them for the fulfillment of his own personal agendas, they feel that they have a historic opportunity, and they're trying to grab as much as they can and perpetuate things that so far have been dealt with in all sorts of bypassing ways. They now want to, for example, legalize the fact that they don't serve in the military, and all sorts of other issues that, from their perspective, it's kind of now or never. So that's the Haredi agenda. And obviously the national religious agenda is a messianic Jewish supremacy agenda that has a lot to do with the occupation of the territories and the settlement movement. And here too, they feel, obviously, God has always been on their side, but now God has also given them a sign, and it's time for them to actually grab,
take advantage of the situation.
Go out and grab everything they can, because they do have an historic opportunity. So these four agendas put together, this is the overall explanation of the putsch that we're seeing. And against that, there is, again, a huge pro-democracy movement that has risen and continues to rise, and I think gives a lot of room for hope for democracy-minded Israelis and democracy-minded pro-Israeli Americans that Israel will prevail, and this crisis will actually be an opportunity for us as a nation to grow, to evolve, to fortify our democracy, to finally attend to very deep problems that so far we have neglected. And there are a number of those that need urgent attention. And obviously this government is doing everything in its power not to resolve, or to resolve in the wrong way. And hopefully the next government will be a huge correction government for the nation.
Well, we're not going to go into the opposition here in this conversation, but I do want to break down, you're mentioning the four different groups of interests. Mm-hmm. I want to start with the Likud, because the Likud used to be the liberal party in Israel, and now it seems to be the populist party. And some will say, if I want to be cynical, that they represent the socialist party in Israel now, because now they control the Histadrut, the labor's unions, which is a completely anomaly, because they always seem to attack the workers, but they control the workers' unions. And they turned from the five memim of Zev Jabotinsky that was talking about welfare to the five calves, as we said it, the KKK of Mickey Zohar. What is happening there? I mean, how do you explain this change in the Likud party over the years?
Well, first of all, they're not only populists, they're national populists. And in that sense, they're very much like their ideological twins in the West, namely Orban in Hungary and the party of so-called freedom and justice in Poland.
In Poland.
And a number of other countries that have gone from full-fledged democracies to hollow democracies or anocracies, or there are all sorts of academic old and new terms for it. But obviously, the Likud party and Netanyahu personally is headed in that direction. And they're also in close connection with some of those regimes and some of the leaders of those coups that unfortunately were successful in those countries. So Likud, as you correctly say, has shifted from a liberal party by definition. Likud, you know, the very name of Likud is Amiflaga Halumit Liberalit, national liberal party.
And national at that time was a patriotic, not nationalist.
Yes.
You know, it's true. Funny because in Hebrew you have two different words, and in English you have one word that can that can go both ways.
You mean national and nationalistic or what?
Yeah, we have Leumi and Leumani.
Yes.
Which Leumi is technically a patriot. What we see on the streets, that's like Leumi.
That's like in English, national and nationalist.
Yeah.
It's the same. So they are nationalist populists. And they abandoned the liberal agenda, at least in terms of their actions. And the explanation, again, goes back to what we said. This is now not about liberal values. It's about fortifying Netanyahu personally and Netanyahu's cult, the cult of the so-called base that Netanyahu cultivates, a lot like Trump and his base, and the relations, generally speaking, between Netanyahu and the so-called Bibism cult on the one hand, and Trump and the MAGA movement on the American side, are very similar. It's a personality cult. It builds on nationalistic, oftentimes anti-liberal, anti-minority, anti-LGBTQ, anti-women, and all of this anti-liberal agenda, plus the personality cult, plus the power grab, the jobs, the monies, everything that goes with it. And this is what Likud has turned to. And because the difference between Trump and Netanyahu is the longevity of their stay in power. Netanyahu has been in power on and off for the last 30 years. There's a whole generation of Israelis for whom the kind of image and concept of a prime minister is very much identified with Netanyahu himself.
The light of the nation, some will say.
Yes, we did have in the last 30 years we did have other prime ministers, but even when Netanyahu was not a prime minister, he had a very heavy influence. And in the last 16 consecutive years, with one exception of 1 year, you know, a year ago,
with the chain block,
he was the prime minister, period. And he cultivated the personality of a prime minister and the image of a prime minister, and has really, unfortunately, again, managed to kind of shape the entire Israeli political system, Israeli political discourse, and the very concepts with which people think about politics and think about issues. Netanyahu has such a dominant presence that this is the way even the so-called opposition thinks, and this is the way the average Israeli thinks. And there are many cases in point. You know, the Iranian nuclear issue is a case in point. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is a case in point. Virtually any other hot-button issue in Israeli politics is now framed by Netanyahu. And this is a challenge that, unfortunately, the current opposition, Gantz, Lapid, are totally incapable of dealing with. For example, in the last government that they were able to create, on most policy issues, they simply continued with Netanyahu's policies. They didn't even think to change it, as unbelievable as it sounds. So in a lot of ways, has already been for the last, I don't know how many years, a hollowed out democracy, dominated and shaped by Netanyahu as prime minister. And Likud was the first political entity that was completely hollowed out and reshaped by Netanyahu to be actually a vehicle in his service. There's nothing left there that is not in direct service to Netanyahu's personal agenda and political agenda that he built. And again, for our American audiences, all you need to do is think about Trump, think about a second Trump term, and then double it by six, because this is the sixth Netanyahu term.
Even though
our terms are shorter than 4 years, but overall he's been prime minister for 16 years. So it's four terms. So think about an America after four Trump terms. This is what you're saying. Yeah.
I think that it's really hard to imagine the U.S. after four terms of Donald Trump. There are already growing conversation about him coming back to the White House in the U.S. And sadly speaking, I think that I don't want to do the comparison and start talking about American politics, but the Democratic Party is doing the same mistakes that the Israeli opposition is doing. Mm-hmm. That they are not leading the conversations and they are going to identity politics and, you know, things that are less relevant to the majority of the people. But that's a different conversation, because I always tell people, if you're talking about civil rights, you're talking about human rights, you're including everybody. You cannot exclude people. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about human rights, you don't need to talk in identity politics. But that's also, it's a hard conversation to have these days.
I think another important thing to mention when we think about Netanyahu, Trump, and their malicious influence on Israel and the U.S. is obviously the treatment of the rule of law and laws in general. And both of these gentlemen have proven that it's worthwhile for a politician, a leader, a head of state, to act as if he is above the law. And the laws do not apply to him. And the gatekeepers and the courts, all the way to the Supreme Courts and the attorney generals and all of those legal officials that are there in order to guard against corruption and guard against misuse of government power and all of that, all of them are made a mockery by both Trump and Netanyahu in a way that, again, unfortunately, caters to their base. And there's a very worrying number or percentage of the population, both here in Israel and in the States, that kind of grown accustomed to this kind of serial abrogations of laws by their leaders, and it's part of their cachet, as much as implausible and weird as it sounds. And again, in this respect, they follow the lead of global figures like Chavez in Venezuela, and Putin in Russia, and so on. Leaders that have, again, put themselves above the law, are despising, openly despising the law. When they have enough power, are reshaping the legal code according to their own needs. And this is what is destroying democracies all over the world. And this is what the fight is about.
We can also dive into the traditional media outlets and the social media's relevance to this discussion. But I want to touch what the Likud is always calling Ashutafim HaTivim, the natural partners or the natural allies.
Yes.
We mentioned two more groups of interest. We have the ultra-Orthodox on one hand and the, what's called religious Zionism, which is not technically religion. I mean, it's some sort of a religious, but it's definitely not Zionism. Let's start with the settlers and the hard right wing, the nationalist right hard wing that today went to the extreme of the extreme. They are being represented by Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is Kahana's successor or protege, and Bezalel Smotrich, who was known to be a provocateur, and he was also indicted in the disengagement when he was trying to act against the IDF. What are their interests in the government?
Well, there's a difference between these two politicians and their parties. Let's start with the so-called Religious Zionism Party and Bezalel Smotrich. This is an old party that was there from the very early days of the country and went through all sorts of incarnations and reincarnations. And it represents essentially the ideological base of the settler movement, what started out as a Gush Emunim and went more and more to the extreme, and is now really, by international standards, far, far right. It is a religious right. It is based on messianic views. It is guided by the most extreme rabbis. It follows doctrines of Jewish supremacy based on essentially racist theories that are supported, quote unquote, or blessed by rabbis and so-called heavenly decrees. They have their own education system. They have their own regions in the country, first and foremost in the settlements. And they were very smart politically in terms of building their power over the years, maximizing their effect on Israeli prime ministers throughout the years, beginning with
Labor and Likud.
Yes, from both sides of the aisle, absolutely. And as we said before, now they feel that they have an opportunity. They have unprecedented strength in the government. They were able to get from Netanyahu essentially everything they wanted. So, for example, Smotrich, their leader, has a very strong hold both on the finance ministry that controls all the budgets, and he's second in command in the defense ministry with his own turf within the ministry that traditionally was held by, at the beginning, more professional individuals, and then, yes, people leaning towards the settlements, but still kind of answering to the defense minister. And I mean the responsibility on all the territories from the Ministry of Defense, because obviously the territories are governed by the IDF. It's a military rule. It's not part of Israel. This anomaly that nobody realizes, or a lot of people don't realize, that actually...
Or ignore, by the way.
Or ignore, yes. But, you know, just think about it. There is a military rule over 3 million Palestinians that is run by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and supervised by the defense ministry. And now the person in charge within the defense ministry is this Bezalel Smotrich, the head of religious Zionism, guided by the most extreme rabbis. His own plan for the future of the territories and the population of the territories is actually a racist plan and essentially amounts to forceful deportation of all those Palestinians who will not succumb to Israeli rule in the, as far as he's concerned, I wanted to say in the future, but as far as he's concerned, you know, it's in the here and now. The minute he has enough power, he'll try to do it, and everything he does is guided by that kind of overall plan. So that's the national religious. And then even more extreme, as you say, the
Jewish power,
the Sab Kahana party,
yeah,
that was outlawed both in Israel and is still outlawed in the States as a terror organization, Kach Kahana Chai. There are two political parties that are on the terror list, the state of the American State Department terror list, alongside the Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad. You have Kach and Kahana Chai. So they changed the name to Jewish Power, but it's essentially the same doctrine. And the Kahana disciples, first and foremost, Ben-Gvir, who is now, absurdly enough, the Minister of National Security, renamed from Interior Security.
And you can see that he's succeeding quite well. I mean, he's taking care of the Jews, neglecting the Arabs. And I think that since January 1st, and we are recording on August 23rd, just yesterday, 5 murders in the Arab society in Israel. For him, it's probably a success. In every normal country, it would be a failure of the Interior Security Department. But for him, it's a great success with, I think, 154 people murdered in the Arab societies since January 1st.
So it's the highest of all times. But I just wanted to say a word about the party as compared to religious Zionism. The Jewish Power Party, which is even more extreme and follows the Kahana doctrines, the political difference between them is that up until now, this Jewish Power Party was considered a pariah, even by Netanyahu and Likud. Was not considered legitimate. In the old days, when Rabbi Kahana was a Knesset member for a short period of time, when he spoke from the podium in the Knesset, Menachem Begin and other Likud leaders left the hall. Now Netanyahu has legitimized them in his desperation and out of his criminal motivations. And this party and the leader, Ben-Gvir, are very adapted to taking advantage of it. What they're doing, because they know they live to a certain extent on borrowed time, because it's very possible that in the next election, certainly if Netanyahu is ousted in some way, shape, or form, that they will be delegitimized again. It might very well be that for Ben-Gvir and his cohorts, this is the first and last term in the Knesset. So they're in a hurry to try and make the most out of their limited time. And yes, of course, try to perpetuate their hold on government funds and on seats in the Knesset and so on. And in order to do that, they are trying essentially to delegitimize the Arab population in using all kinds of instruments, including legal instruments, including media campaigns and everything in their power. So, for example, one of the laws that have been submitted to the Knesset has to do with the possibility of banning certain political parties. And it's worded in such a way that it's very clear it is designed to outlaw Arab parties using all sorts of manufactured justifications, like, you know, being anti-patriot or whatever. If a party wants to use the law in order to outlaw other parties, it can be very creative. And of course, if the Supreme Court is weakened according to the judicial putsch plan, then who's exactly going to stop them? Who exactly is going to stop them? So they're on a march against the Arabs. They're on a march to try and make their episode in the Knesset as long and as influential as possible. And in that sense, they're a little different from their religious Zionist twin.
But eventually, both of them are pulling money to budget the settlers, and the settlers, I would say, hold in the West Bank without looking at the long-term results.
Oh, they are
more likely to happen if you are not messianic, I would say.
They are looking at the long-term results, and they're, as we said, they're striving to a situation in which the West Bank will be fully occupied, fully legalized, even though, of course, it will not be recognized by the international community. but they want to annex the entire territory. They want essentially to transfer the population to Jordan. If it takes another great war to do it, they're absolutely okay with it. And that's the kind of nightmare that they're planning and executing as we speak, using their government ministries, government budgets, government jobs, access to the media, and so on.
And that's something that they've been doing successfully, by the way, for years, putting, you know, people in the media and in the army and in the bureaucracy in Israel. They've been doing it for years. And now they have enough allies, you can say, that they are helping them out.
Yes, they've gained more power. Their kind of mutual dependency with Netanyahu is giving them a huge opportunity from their perspective. And they're using it.
I will say one thing, you know, you mentioned that religious Zionism, it originated from the Mafdal that was a lot more moderate than what we see today. I think that the revolution started in 67 after the Six-Day War with Rav Kook and his prophecy of Etchalta de Geula.
Yeah.
So that's them. The ultra-Orthodox, they seem to be getting slammed the most, by the way, by the protesters. But we need to separate them to two different sections because you have Shas and Arya Deri, which work in one way, and you have what you call the original Haredim, the Ashkenazim, UTJ, that has their own way. And it seems, first thing, that they're not always aligned with each other, but they work in the same direction. What can you tell about that?
I actually don't think we should separate them. They are absolutely identical in terms of their agendas. Yes, there are differences, but the common denominator is much stronger. Deri himself, the leader of Shas, is obviously a serial criminal, was the subject of a Supreme Court verdict that prevents him from maintaining his position as a minister, and he's obviously trying everything in order to regain it. And Shas as a party is very much focused on getting more and more budgets, getting more and more government jobs. They've already annexed the Ministry of Interior years ago, which is a very powerful ministry in Israel that controls budgets to the municipalities and many other aspects of daily lives. And it has undergone a complete revolution in the last decades because most of this time was Minister of Interior. And in terms of their agenda vis-a-vis the regime change, they're absolutely siding with Netanyahu, Deri himself, and the entire party, which essentially is comprised of puppets that he nominated and controls. And their agenda is identical to Netanyahu's. There's no difference. And it is identical also to the Ashkenazi Haredim that you mentioned. They're all after perpetuating and legalizing the model that has brought them so far, which is not serving in the army, avoiding the labor market, living on government subsidies, all the time financing their own separatist educational systems that are totally politicized, teach only Torah and Gemara and holy Jewish scripts, not science, not math, not English, not civics, and they actually educate their masses as future voters and future disciples in a way that is absolutely detrimental to the future of Israel. And there are already predictions that, you know, if this path is not stopped and not blocked, then within 20, 30 years, the Israeli economic model will collapse because simply what is now the working majority will by then be the working minority and the serving minority and will no longer be able to sustain the other parts of the society, first and foremost, the Haredim, both Ashkenazi and Sephardi, if they don't go into the labor market and if they continue to avoid military or national service. This is why we are now in such a critical juncture. It's not only because of Netanyahu's initiative of an overall regime change. It is also the fact that unless we make a very hard turn away from the path that we're on in terms of the future of the country, the demographics, everything we said about those segments of the population that are not contributing to the GDP, that are not serving in the military, unless we change that, the country is bound to collapse and become a third world country and not the Israel that most, if not all of us, are looking to see.
And everything that you mentioned is what's allowing the ultra-Orthodox female to be the most, I don't like using the term, but the most productive when it comes to, mm-hmm. to baby, I don't like to say baby production, but to have big families. And it's only about the welfare system. And there is a big backlash. I think that the ultra-Orthodox are the first one to be slammed in this coalition by the general public, because there is such hard experience of, if we're talking about women, then the women elimination from the public sphere and everything that is going on with, you know, now we have the new rail, light railway in Tel Aviv. Congratulations, by the way, that we have it finally. Yes. That is not working on Shabbat, even though it's completely electric and you can, you, I think that it has no driver. I mean, technically, I think it works only, it's programmed. So I don't know what are the problems. You can make it free on weekends and then nobody's working for it. But so they are the ones to be slammed, because they are the ones that hurts, I would say, the Chilonim the most. And now comes the next term of the Knesset. They are actually, I would say, threatening Netanyahu in a way that they will not collaborate with him unless he will promote legitimizing the ultra-Orthodox and being undrafted from the military service.
Yes.
And we'll see what's going to be with that. But that's going to be a big, that's a big bump for Netanyahu. I think that he's also aware that all of the rallies that we see now, if him and the Likud will legitimize that, I don't know what's going to be the outcome of that.
A lot of people really view it in the way that you just described it, like as if they're squeezing Netanyahu and pushing him and so on. But it's not entirely true. It is written very clearly in the coalition agreements that were agreed upon 8 months ago when the coalition was formed. Netanyahu did not have to sign those agreements, could have negotiated differently, but chose to give the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, essentially everything they asked for, including legalizing them not serving in the army, which has been the case, by the way, not since the creation of the State of Israel, not since 1948, although many people think so, but only since 1978, after Begin and the Likud. Yes. Yeah. For the first 30 years of the existence of the State of Israel, those ultra-Orthodox youngsters served in the military and the skies did not fall. So they simply got used to this system of not serving, living on government subsidies, not working and so on. And there's a huge corrupt establishment of rabbis and yeshivas and all sorts of religious institutions whose life depends on continuation of this model. This is why, obviously, they're trying to force it on the entire population. But they are now meeting an unprecedented backlash to an extent that they did not foresee and Netanyahu did not foresee. And as part of the uprise against the overall coup that Netanyahu is staging, there is now a great amount of resistance by the secular population against the continuation, certainly the legalization of the so-called status quo of the Haredim not serving in the military. And I don't think it's going to stand. I think Netanyahu realizes that. He's already struggling to try and convince the signatories to his own coalition agreements that he won't be able to abide by those agreements. And of course, they're fighting back and trying to force the execution of the agreement. And as you say, we'll see what happens. This could bring the government down, potentially. And obviously, the Supreme Court also has a role here, because if they do push it through the Knesset, it's very, very possible the Supreme Court will strike it down. And yes, hundreds of thousands will take to the streets. And this is just one more kind of a vector influencing reality. And they're all pushing in the same direction, the direction of escalating civil war that has already started, and might very well escalate until this government falls and until Netanyahu is driven out of power.
I want to ask you one last question. We're talking about favoritism and looting. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy question, but do you really mm-hmm. believe that a different government, okay, mm-hmm. that will come after this current coalition will make the necessary changes in order to strengthen the gatekeepers, to strengthen the bureaucracy, and to allow a more reasonable, I would say, budgeting in Israel?
It's a very good question. You know why you're asking it. Personally, I have zero trust in all of the existing politicians and the political parties. They've all proven incapable of addressing the root problems of Israeli society in any way, shape, or form. As we said before, the previous government mostly continued Netanyahu's policies on most, if not all, of the issues, even though it was led by so-called opposition. And once we have elections, and hopefully we should hope that we'll have elections, because Netanyahu and this government will do whatever they can in order to prevent free and fair elections in the near future. So assuming we do have free and fair elections, hopefully we'll have new political power and new political agendas and promises that will have to be made to the pro-democracy side of the Israeli constituency that will bring it to the polls in unprecedented numbers, which will force Netanyahu and his coalition out, which will replace it by a liberal democratic coalition. And with the power and the motivation and the capabilities to really address the core problems of the nation, fortify democracy, we need to undergo processes not unlike those that America underwent in the last 3 years after January 6th, and to a certain extent, even more, because we are a younger democracy. Our democratic structures are much weaker. We don't have a constitution, and we have all sorts of unique problems, like the problem of the ultra-Orthodox and those separatist autonomies that we allowed to thrive with our tax monies and, in a completely segregated way, let alone the whole issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the occupation. So we have really unique problems that have been buried all over the years and neglected by the politicians because they're so complicated. And hopefully this immense crisis will necessitate the next government and the next wave of liberal democratic politicians to finally address them in a fundamental way.
Eran Etzion, thank you very much for this conversation and for shedding light on this coalition. It wasn't an easy conversation.
Shedding light on this dark coalition, yes.
Yes. So thank you
for the opportunity.
It was a pleasure having you again at Balagan. And until the next time, goodbye.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
If you found this episode enlightening or thought-provoking, be sure to subscribe to Balagan on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, leave me a review. Your feedback means the world to me and helps others to discover the show. Of course, sharing the episode link with others will also be greatly appreciated. Remember, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Join me on Balagan's Facebook group to continue discussing today's episode and connect with fellow listeners. I would love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions for future topics. You are more than welcome to check my website, www.balaganil.com, for additional resources. I'm committed to connecting you with Israel and providing you with proper context. Until the next time, remember that knowledge is power. Keep learning, keep growing, and continue engaging with Israel. I can't wait to catch you in the next episode of Balagan.